You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge. Social Threefolding, Christ, Lucifer, and Ahriman. 15 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on the 11th of October, 1919. It is so late now that I will keep this lecture short and leave for tomorrow the main point I wish to make in these three lectures. Tomorrow the eurythmy will come earlier on in the day, and then the lecture can be of the proper length. Last time I suggested that to counteract the forces of decline in our society today, we need to differentiate between different populations across the globe, and really recognize what lives in these different swaths of the earth's people, in the Anglo-Americans, in the Europeans, and in the people of the East. We saw that the disposition to establish a modern cosmogony, a connection with the cosmos, is found, above all, amongst the Anglo-American peoples, that the capacity to develop the impulse of freedom lives in the European peoples, and that the impulse to develop altruism, religiosity, and what is connected with this as human fraternity, is discernible among the peoples of the East. A new civilization can only be established if people across the globe find ways to really work together. For real collaboration between them to become possible, various things are necessary. We must open our eyes to the great lack in this modern civilization, to the forces of decline at work there. But we ought not to see everything at work there as bad. This would be unhistorical, firstly, and secondly would not lead to any positive outcome. The impulses within our civilization were once justified and had their proper place and time. But everything that leads to decline in humanity's history does so because something that was right for a particular time and place survives into a different and now inappropriate place and time. And because, under certain Ahrimanic and Luciferic inspirations, people stay with what they have become accustomed to, instead of seeking to participate in humanity's real progress. Our era is proud of its scientific rigor, and yet from this science proceed the greatest social errors and disfigurements of our time. We must therefore shine a clear light upon the mechanisms of thinking and on action too, insofar as it is, of course, very much dependent on modern thinking. In the context we were considering yesterday, we saw how the Earth's whole culture is composed of three strands, of scientific culture, political and democratic culture, and the culture of economic altruism, the latter basically looking back to an altruistic religious element. When people today, as I have already indicated, observe the forces at work in our social structure, they stay on the surface and are disinclined to penetrate deeper. In universities, professors lecture on the economic wisdoms of the day in a way that is based on modern scientific methodologies. But what lives in human beings and human sensibilities is seen more or less as an undigestible gruel. No account is taken of the real facts. Let us stay for a moment with European culture. What is its most salient trait? To understand this, we have to go back a fairly long way and see how this European population, with all its religious, political, economic, and scientific impulses, gradually emerged from more ancient Celtic origins and impulses when diverse later strata of the population interwove themselves with these origins, which are still basically present in the depths of our European culture. In contrast to the American West and the Asiatic East, a certain intellectualism reigned always in Europe. What I described yesterday as the intrinsic nature of Roman culture, the Roman element, could never have gained such sway if the underlying traits of intellectualism had not already existed within European civilization. Now, intellectualism possesses two characteristics. Firstly, it is unable to bestir itself to entirely dismiss religious impulses. Under the influence of intellectualism, religious impulses acquire an ever more abstract character. And equally, intellectualism is unable, really, to develop the impetus to engage with practical economic life. You will see from the experiments currently underway in Russia how impossible it is for European intellectualism to bring order into economic life. What Leninism develops is the purest intellectualism. It is all conceptual, a social order constructed out of thinking. And the attempt is being made to foist this social system spun from thinking upon actual conditions existing between human beings. Over time, it will become apparent, in the most dire way, how impossible it is to graft an intellectual conception on the social structure in this way. People today are not yet willing to grasp the full import of these things. In the European populace lives the dire trait of somnolence, this inability of the whole human being to participate in what we so much need to stream through European society. But first and foremost, we must grasp what underpins this European civilization and the origin it has emerged from, really. In its own intrinsic nature, this European civilization has produced only a culture of intellectualism, a culture of thoughts. In our science reigns the sedate aridity of thinking, and this holds sway also in our social institutions. We have experienced this intellectualism for many, many decades in the parliaments of Europe. There has been a palpable sense in all these European parliaments that they are informed by the intellectual and utilitarian perspective, an element lacking in energy, without any impetus for religious impulses, nor any either for economic impulses. Just think for a moment how we acquired our religious life. We can see from the whole historical development of this religious life that Europe itself possesses no intrinsic religious impulses. Consider how prosaic, infinitely prosaic was the world as the Roman Empire expanded, sober and prosaic in the extreme. And all this was just the beginning. Consider what Europe would have become if Roman culture, with its prosaic sobriety, had simply continued without the impulse, a religious impulse, that came over from the Asiatic East. If it had continued without the Christian impulse, what sprang forth from the womb of the Orient and could never have emerged from the womb of Europe, this religious impulse came toward us as a wave of culture, of civilization from the East. Europe, after all, at first did nothing other than stuff Roman legal concepts into this religious impulse arriving from the East, pervading it with sober, abstract, intellectual, juristic forms. The Eastern religious impulse was basically alien to European life, and remained so. It never entirely amalgamated itself with the European character. And in Protestantism, in a curious way, it has, in a sense, been separated out, as though in a test tube. In a test tube, you can watch how substances separate out from each other. And the same thing happened with the religious character of European civilization. In the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, there was something like an attempt to configure an inner unity between religious feeling and sensibility and scientific and economic thinking. But then, really in the same way as two substances separate out in a test tube, the two, the prosaic thinking of intellectualism and the religious impulse, diverged. And at last, we had Protestantism, Lutheranism. Science on the one hand as one truth, and faith on the other as the other truth. The two are now irreconcilable. In fact, it is seen as sacrilegious to try to imbue the contents of faith with the contents of thinking, to warm up the content of thought with that of faith. And then came the most prosaic thing of all, that most intellectual Kantianism, which set its critique of pure reason against a critique of practical reason, of ethics against science, creating the most terrible, yawning gulf between two things that must be felt and experienced as one within human nature. And European civilization still really continues to live with these circumstances, under which it will increasingly decline. The religious impulse in the East was assimilated as something alien, and did not unite organically with the rest of Europe's cultural and physical life. It is important to note this. Look, enough misplaced praise has been heaped on the progress of modern civilization. This praise kept on flowing until millions of people had been murdered within our civilization, and three times as many had been made cripples. Sanctimonious speeches were intoned from pulpits until the blood flowed freely and unendingly. This much vaunted progress was proclaimed from pulpits until it showed itself to be a void. No salvation will come until we look these things squarely in the face. And now come all those of Leninist and other persuasions, reflecting on socialism and economic doctrine. And they imagine that the ideas that have long proven inadequate for governing European civilization will reform our economic order, our social order, without the need for any new ideas, for any new thinking. I have, I think, previously spoken of the fine ideas that our scholars and academics arrive at in these fields. Very fine. And so I'd like to air these matters once again here. There is a famous economist called Lujo Brentano, who wrote an article a while back entitled The Entrepreneur. Brentano tries to construct the concept of the capitalist entrepreneur, and for this purpose gathers together various traits. The third such characteristic which he cites is that the entrepreneur uses the means of production in the service of humanity at his own risk, at his own peril. And now our good Lujo Brentano examines the function of the ordinary manual worker in society and says that the manual laborer's means of production are his own physical capacity for work. and that he uses this in the service of society at his own risk and peril. Thus the worker is an entrepreneur, and there is no difference between them. And so you can see how completely confused scientific or academic thinking has become. People create concepts in which they can no longer make any distinction between two opposite poles. But this isn't as apparent in Brentano's work as in that of a professor of philosophy in Bern, who has written such an extraordinary number of books that he cannot have had enough time to think exactly what he was writing. Nevertheless, he gave lectures on philosophy at Bern University. And in one of them, we can read the following sentence, quote, "Civilization can only develop in the temperate zone, not at the North Pole, where it would freeze solid, nor at the South Pole, where it is hot compared to the North Pole, and civilization would burn up in the heat," close quote. Strange to say, there really is a proper professor of philosophy who wrote so much, so quickly, that his writings include the idea that it is cold at the North Pole and hot at the South Pole. The economic errors of our good friend Brentano are born basically from the same superficial appraisal of things as much else in Europe. What exists already is regarded as a given, and one's conceptual schemas are simply related to that. People learn this from scientific methodology. Scientific institutes teach it. And people in our day, an era, supposedly, when no heed is given to authority any longer, simply parrot it back. When told that someone is an authority on something, they think this is a reason to assume he is telling the truth. Rather than insight into the truth of a statement, people accept it because the person who made it is a supposed authority. And so economic realities are all regarded as equal in importance alongside each other, whereas in fact they are interpenetrating elements that must be examined separately. Just as European civilization received the religious impulse flowing toward it from the East, so something else was necessary for its economic structure. As the fifth post-Atlantean era approached, toward the middle of the 15th century, this was also a time when events occurred that were to affect the whole of modern civilization and give it its basic character and countenance: the discovery of America, the discovery of the sea route past the Cape of Good Hope to the East Indies. This formed and determined our subsequent civilization. And Europe's whole economic development cannot be studied in terms of Europe alone. It is nonsense to think that studying economic factors in European society will reveal the economic laws at work there. We only unearth these laws if we continually recognize that Europe was able to expel or export countless things to America. And the whole structure of Europe only arose by virtue of the fact that there was a new world to be found over there in the West, to which Europe dispatched its economic impulse, just as it had received the religious impulse from the East. Its own economy developed under the regime of this current, this flow, just as its spiritual and cultural life developed under the influence of religious impulses from the East. European life, the whole background to the development of European civilization, developed in the context of these two streams over past centuries. Here you have European civilization in the middle, and from the East you have an influx of the religious impulse, and there's a drawing, while toward the West flowed the dispatch or discharge of the economic impulse. These things lived in the developing civilization of Europe. Now at the end of the 19th century, this reached a certain crisis point. It started to falter, becoming more sluggish than it had been in the past 400 years. Today we are still affected by this faltering, still live with its consequences. The religious impulse entered Europe as something alien and gave rise to our cultural and spiritual life. And our economic life arose by continually diluting itself. If America had not existed, and our economy had been compelled to emerge by its own laws alone, it could not have continually scattered abroad what it could not use, and could not have developed in Europe as it did. Now, this comes to a standstill, and so an inner escape must be found. From within, a means must be found to introduce into the proper channels what can no longer be effected by shipping things off elsewhere. This must happen through threefolding. This must happen by really organically membering things that have become haphazardly interwoven. There is more than just one reason why the social organism should be membered in a threefold way. There are all kinds of reasons for it, scientific, economic, historical reasons. To make a proper assessment of the justification for a threefold social organism, we must be able to survey all these diverse reasons. It is important to say this today, since modern people suffer from such conceptual poverty, one that has assumed really dire proportions. Anyone with a sense for ideas finds a really very small sum of ideas holding sway in our cultural life today. Wherever you look, you find the same ideas, whether you're studying a work on physics, on geology, biology, psychology, or whatever field you like. Different facts, but precisely the same ideas. The facts of psychology, for instance, consist really only of words, since people know the psyche only as a sum of words. If they speak of the will, it is just a word, and nothing is known of the real nature of the will. If they speak of thinking, they know nothing of the real nature of thinking, since they think only in words. Nor do they know anything about feeling. The whole field of psychology is a game of words today, spliced together in the most varied ways. Just as in a kaleidoscope the little pieces of glass assume different shapes and patterns, the same is true of our concepts. In our different disciplines, they are cast into different arrangements. But there is only a very small sum of ideas that you continually encounter, which are grafted onto the facts. People do not try too hard to find concepts that correspond to reality, the ideas that really belong to the subject of inquiry. But these things go unnoticed. A little while ago, in a city in Central Europe, radical socialists held a congress. They were trying to work out a social structure for Europe, roughly the same as you can read about at present in a series of articles in the Basel journal titled Vorwärts. The characteristic thing about this social structure, which people consider very ingenious and perfectly conceived, is that it was created by people who have never really had anything to do with economic life, who have never really acquainted themselves with the actual sources and driving forces in economic life. It was created by people who participated in politics in recent decades. And how did they do so? Well, either by being a voter or an elected representative. As a political candidate, you were either elected in a first or second ballot. If you weren't elected in the first ballot, you might run out of election funds. These sums had been spent. During this first round of the campaign, the parties would have castigated their opponents, accusing them of being rogues and deceivers or something still worse. Then came the second ballot. So far, no party would have had a majority. And now, in the second ballot, it was a question of electing one of the parties with a relative majority. At which point a different procedure came into force. You got your opponent, who until then had been a rogue, a deceiver, and so on, to pay you back a third of the election funds spent in return for your backing of him. Suddenly your opponent, the rogue, was a man who needed to be elected. You got a third of your election funds back, and in the interests of recouping this sum, you became a supporter of the one who had previously been dismissed as a charlatan, and so on. Someone had to be elected after all, and your candidate had no prospects of being elected. So you cut your losses by recouping a third of the funds you had spent. So this is the kind of political life in which people participated. The political administration was subject to this kind of string-pulling, and people learned to exert political influence. They became adept with this whole political machinery, but didn't have a clue about economic life. People sought to graft the political ideas they acquired in the process, ideas which were, of course, very corrupt, but were, after all, still political concepts, onto economic life, imposed them on it. When realized, this would give rise to an economic life with a purely political structure. Today, people confuse the structure of economic life with political structure, and are unable to keep separate things that have gradually become fused and entangled. But what we need today is growing insight everywhere into real conditions, something people are very averse to developing. But it should not be thought that the true reality we seek through anthroposophically oriented spiritual science can be discovered under the influence of a civilization that tyrannizes over external reality with a few dogmatic concepts, rather than actually observing it. Anthroposophically oriented spiritual science aims to uncover true reality, and therefore it cannot be founded on the model provided by religious confessions of the past. This was the enormously painful aspect of the old theosophical movement. What else was it really but the desire for a kind of extra religion? It did not consist of a new impulse arising amidst European civilization itself, but only of feelings that had already existed in the old religious element. People had grown weary of these old religious concepts and feelings, and so they turned to something different. But what they turned to was pervaded by the same atmosphere as that of the old confessions. People wished to be pious in the same way as Protestants or Catholics, rather than finding what was really needed, a truly new religious impulse alongside other impulses. And this was because the European population had become accustomed to a life imbued with an alien Asiatic religious impulse. That is the important thing. And until spheres that have only been artificially fused become organically interwoven, European civilization cannot make progress. This is a very serious matter. And this sense must imbue what needs to live in science, in economics, and in religiosity and political life. The end of Lecture 5.